Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
And from Wall Street to Orange County, we are back on the Inside Lacrosse Podcast for the MCLA. This is now the third venue that we're recording from. We started off in a small section of the CBS Sports, the old CBS College Sports Studio down in Chelsea. Got a little bit of an equipment upgrade and was recording this out of my old apartment in Brooklyn, and recently moved downtown to the border of Tribeca in the Financial District, and now recording from my brand new apartment. Really exciting show as always. We are in mid-April and May Madness is upon us. That means bracketology and postseason. The conference tournaments are underway. Everybody's getting their calculators out, trying to figure out what quality wins they're going to need in the postseason in order to get at-large bids if they don't get their coveted conference titles. And we're very fortunate to be joined by a pretty popular guest analyst. Andrew Laycock was a guest when we first started the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast back in 2012 when he was a junior and a first-year player at Grand Valley State. Wrote a great piece on his experience playing at the Palm Beach Atlantic Shootout, and we had him on with Terry Foy to discuss that experience. We were fortunate to catch up with Andrew and his head coach Tim Murray in Greenville, South Carolina later that spring, and had him at Radio Row for the championship podcast, where we were able to catch up with Andrew last year back in Greenville, but unfortunately was not able to have him back as a guest. But now a Grand Valley State graduate, class of 2013, working in Fort Wayne, Indiana in the brewery business, but still very much connected to MCLA lacrosse as a fan and a commentator. And Andrew, very excited to have you back.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Andrew, you know, we really have a lot to talk about. I'm really excited to talk about some of your personal experiences as a player in the postseason. You won two CCLA championships at Grand Valley State and also had experience playing Division III lacrosse at Trine. So a lot of really interesting things to pick at here. But, you know, we'll start things off. You know, you spent 2 years at the tournament in Greenville, two consecutive years. It seemed like the atmosphere kind of changed. Year one, it was almost a redemption year. The weather was much better compared to seasons past in Denver. And last year didn't necessarily have all the bells and whistles that an MCLA tournament is known to have. For the most part, from your experience having played in Greenville twice, Andrew, what do you think are the pros and cons of the location?
I think there's a few pros, but a lot of cons, honestly. You know, the fields really weren't in that good a condition either year. The stadium that we're playing in for the semifinals and finals just was not in good condition. Patchy holes. I mean, just not a good field. The soccer complex where the first two rounds were played at had some drainage problems. You know, I don't know if it was kind of makeshift. It just didn't seem like that good a fit for the first two round games. The stadium itself for the semifinals and finals, I think, would have been good if the field was in a lot better condition. But, you know, it was an outdated stadium, and the field just really weren't ready to play on.
Field conditions definitely an issue in Greenville. Serene Stadium certainly did not have the lack and the luster of past venues such as Dick's Sporting Goods Park in Denver and the old Cowboy Stadium in Irving, Texas, as well as Pizza Hut Park, the MLS home of the Dallas Burn. And, you know, one of the biggest issues that a lot of programs had really addressed, especially being in a Western-leaning league, was traveling out to Greenville, South Carolina, not the easiest place to go. And by that demand, the MCLA answered the bell and decided to switch gears and bring the tournament to Orange County, California. Andrew, it's a shame that you know, you're a graduate and you won't be able to experience two different venues firsthand. But, you know, as a commentator, as someone who's still very connected to your alma mater in the MCLA community, what do you think will be different and better about competing out in Southern California?
Well, you know, I think it's been a great experience. You know, the area that these games are going to take place at, I think, is very cool. I like that the championship games, the semifinal and championship games, will be at the Chapman Stadium. You know, you got a turf field, so you know that the conditions won't be a problem, which is good. Playing at UC Irvine for the first two rounds, I think is going to be good, just because I can only assume that the university keeps those fields in better shape because they're used more frequently. You know, I just think all around it's a better experience. The fields are going to be better. It's tough for all the teams in the Midwest and out East that have to travel that far, but you know, I guess a week long vacation in California isn't that bad.
Yeah, that's pretty much been the theme. I've been talking to coaches all week, and it seems like kids are at least very excited to check out California, regardless of how far away it is. It's you know, even though it's going to be a long trip for the East Coast guys and the Midwest guys, you know, LAX is essentially a little bit of an easier place to fly into than Spartanburg, South Carolina. So I think that people are most enthused by that. And so far, you're pretty much spot on. Everything that I've heard from the MCLA administration, from the executive level to the host committee in Southern California, seems like Irvine's really ready to go for the early round games. And Chapman, as you mentioned, is very used to hosting high magnitude MCLA games. The Lacrosse Network has broadcasted there more than a few times, so they'll be familiar with the venue when they are putting the games on the internet to be viewed by the nation. And the turf field, absolutely. When dealing with questionable weather, which just seems to be a theme in May, no matter where you are, the turf at Chapman should definitely give some more consistency to the event. So, you know, moving on, Andrew, you know, you and I have the fact in common, a few things in common. We both transferred to the MCLA from Division III programs to MCLA Division II programs. And, you know, one of the biggest arguments about the Division II tournament field for the past few years that affected you as a player, to a certain degree, because this team and this conference was a part of your tournament, was the Lone Star Alliance. In Division I, they're probably having their best year ever with three ranked teams between Texas, Texas State, and SMU. But Division II did lose their automatic qualifying bid. They do not have the six non-FBS football schools in the division in order to qualify for the national tournament. So Sam Houston State, who's always dominated that division, probably will not be competing this year. They're having a down year, so the at-large does not look likely. And you know, regardless of who wins that conference championship, it doesn't look like that champion will make it out to Orange County, California. Andrew, from your experience, you know, you've been compared to Sam Houston in the past. You've been ranked similarly at certain points in your career, but they were a program that was criticized for never performing well in the tournament. Now that the LSA doesn't have this bid, do you think that the elevation of play for the tournament field is going to elevate, or do you think it's really a shame that Sam Houston, who's had so much notoriety in the past, probably won't be part of this year's national championship?
Well, I think you brought up a good point that they have not performed. Their last 3 years in the tournament, they've lost in the first round. You know, in my opinion, I like the best teams getting in, regardless of the AQs. You know, it's too bad that they do lose the AQ because of the ruling. But in my opinion, I'm not that disappointed that they're not going to make it. I think the best team should. You know, they had a down year. You know, 4-4 was their overall schedule. Yeah, they went 4-0 in the conference, but you know. A 500 season, not that good. Conference isn't that great. You know, it's a disappointment from the conference standpoint. Sam Houston not getting in, it's not that big a deal to me. But just like you said, I'm very impressed with their Division I. Three schools being ranked. Texas State is a big surprise for me this year.
Yeah, Texas State being led by Mike Brands, really being pulled forward by transfer attackman out of Bellarmine that they stole out of Canada, really just doing a lot of impressive things. So we'll see if the LSA actually gets an unfamiliar two bid in Division I, but it doesn't look like they'll get that Division II representation. And, you know, as this will ultimately make room for more high quality teams. And, you know, the CCLA has always been dominant in MCLA Division II. But surprisingly enough, this year is even more dominant than years past. Dayton is back. Lourdes has come out of complete nowhere and is a very highly ranked team. Your alma mater is doing outstanding. Indiana Tech beat St. Thomas this year. You know, what do you, you know, all this being said, you know, as a CCLA alum and seeing how some of these programs have expanded, you know, obviously the LSA's loss will probably be the CCLA's gain, but, you know, what do you think predicates the growth in both size, quality, and quantity as far as CCLA Division II is concerned? It seems like all the big guys are performing better than they ever have, and this program from Lourdes has really come out of nowhere.
Yeah, you know, I think with Lourdes, first year program, what helps them, NAIA, means
Absolutely.
they give a lot of money. So that means that helps attract players regardless. You know, and honestly, at the same time, Lourdes does have a pretty weak schedule. I mean, I know they have a pretty good record. They're 11-2. You know, their losses are Dayton, Grove City. If you look at their wins, the closest game was actually to Aquinas. You know, they don't play a lot of talent. So you know, good for them to have 11 wins. I don't know how far they're going to go in the tournament if they even make it. Unlikely, I think. But you know, it's good to see new programs in the league. That's what MCLA is for, is just more growth around lacrosse. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you bring up a very interesting point on the NAIA dynamic, and we'll get to that in just a second. But you know, we bring up the fact that we're both NCAA transfers, and the MCLA does a really fantastic job to, you know, really bring, you know, this virtual varsity theme to fruition by really holding NCAA eligibility rules very tightly within their own infrastructure. And you know, it's just a very interesting dynamic because you know, the NCAA does not recognize MCLA years of eligibility. And the best example to give is a guy like Kevin Crowley, probably one of the best lacrosse players on the planet right now, the MVP of the MLL last year, played for a year at Simon Fraser, but then was able to make a move to Stony Brook where he put in 4 years. And, you know, if the NCAA recognized MCLA eligibility, he probably would have only had three. And we talk about growth and we talk about matriculation. More schools than ever are moving into the MCLA with the intention to go into the NCAA soon, and some of the more progressive programs are also looking to forecast and making that move. You know, what are your thoughts in regards to the NCAA starting to recognize MCLA eligibility? It seems like at this point, you know, that these entities just kind of have to begin to work together in order to preserve what is the purest thing about college sports, which is amateurism.
Yeah, you know, the NCAA is such a bully, maybe is the word to use, and they really just don't care about anybody else, to be honest. Such strict rules, and they believe, you know, it's only them. I like that the MCLA does respect the NCAA eligibility. I think it gives the MCLA more credibility. I don't think I ever see the NCAA, you know, recognizing years played in the MCLA. I just don't see it happening. Because it is, you know, sort of a lower level of lacrosse, to be honest. It's kind of like, you know, you didn't play NCAA, so you haven't played yet. Sort of like a you know, junior college transfer in football. I mean, you know, you get this chance to kind of get better, and then you can go bigger. I don't see NCAA ever recognizing the MCLA, but I'm glad that the MCLA does recognize it. I think it just makes them look better.
Yeah, I completely agree. And let's kind of stay on this topic for, you know, just one more minute. You know, let's talk about this eligibility thing a little bit more and how it affects your program specifically. Charlie Farmer, a kid who you got to play with last year, played for a year at High Point University when the school was still in flux in regards to becoming an official NCAA program. And the first year that they had recruits on campus and were building the program, they did scrimmage both NCAA and MCLA schools. And because Charlie Farmer had played games against Tennessee and Virginia Tech specifically, whether they were sanctioned or not by High Point, Charlie lost the year of eligibility. But we all know that if the situation was reversed and if a player was going from the MCLA to NCAA, he wouldn't necessarily lose eligibility. And with more schools matriculating from the MCLA to the NCAA, most notably having announced recently Palm Beach Atlantic, you know, is it fair on Charlie that he, you know, you said that, you know, you've already mentioned that, you know, you think that it's a good thing that the MCLA at least recognizes NCAA eligibility rules for the sake of their legitimacy. But the way that the situation has played out, is it really fair individually for Charlie Farmer? And what is it going to mean for Palm Beach Atlantic if they're able to retain their roster and continue playing MCLA lacrosse for the next couple seasons and then ultimately retain kids, keep them eligible, keep them in school for however long as undergraduates, and then, you know, get 4 years of eligibility? Does that make a lot of sense to you?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult. In Charlie's situation, it's really tough. I mean, you know, I played with a guy at Trine who broke his wrist right on the cusp of that playing enough games versus not playing enough games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he fought it, and ultimately he did win an extra year. You know, so there are those cases where you could apply, you could get another year back. It's so frustrating that there are rules like that keep players kind of, you know, not being able to play the game that they love. So, you know, there's always going to be situations like that. And it's frustrating. Hopefully you can apply for another year and the NCAA will grant it. You know, in terms of Palm Beach Atlantic, you know, in my mind, I like seeing more teams move up to NCAA. It just, is helpful for the sport of lacrosse. But yeah, I think they will dominate their last year, maybe 2 years of MCLA, just because you know that they're going to be getting varsity transfers, they're going to be getting varsity recruited athletes, and some players are fine playing 5 years of college if they can. You know, they play 1 year of MCLA, they're a high recruit, and you know they get a sit 1 year kind of, you know, and then they get to go play NCAA Division II. I think it's attractive, and I think they'll be a powerhouse their last year in the MCLA.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they fell a little bit short this year. They certainly play in a very tough division of the SCLC, which has been very, very strong in Division II. Not quite at that Midwestern level yet, but, you know, always a conference that people are keeping their eyes on. They do get started early, and they attract the Midwestern talent down there for some pretty quality home games. And Palm Beach Atlantic has certainly benefited from that, as you know, when they're able to host the PBA shootout. And not even in NCAA Division II. University of Richmond had players playing MCLA last year that Dan Chamati had recruited that, you know, got a couple of games of MCLA lacrosse under their belt and are really only playing their first year of college lacrosse as far as the NCAA is concerned now. And, you know, you look at it on both sides of the coin, you know, it might not be fair to some people, but I think that you're ultimately right that as far as the overall growth and competitive nature for the sport of lacrosse and matriculating into the highest level of the NCAA, it's essentially a good thing to keep kids on the field as long as they can. It's just, you know, an interesting dichotomy between the two ways between the way that the two leagues exist. And as you said, it's probably not likely that the NCAA will really ever recognize the MCLA years played as eligibility. But, you know, let's shift gears back into your conference and Division I for that matter. At this point, Michigan State is going to Orange County. Their win over Colorado pretty much solidifies that. Their loss to Davenport aside, they would have to have a near meltdown in the CCLA tournament to keep them for Orange County. On the flip side, Davenport really needs to win the conference tournament in order to solidify their bid and bring Michigan State with them. As a CCLA guy and also as a guy that recognizes that some of the better teams in Division I do come from further out west, and having said that, you know, Sam Houston not being in the Division II tournament will benefit from other higher-level teams getting there. Overall, when you think about the Division I tournament field, do you think it will be best if Michigan State just wins the conference and goes outright and makes extra room for an extra WCLL, RMLC, SLC team? Or do you think that the tournament field would actually be best with representation from both Michigan State and your arch rival Davenport?
Well, since I didn't play in the CCLA, I have to say that I hate admitting that I think it'd be better if just Michigan State went. You know, Davenport just really haven't proven that they can be, you know, a top 10 team. And I think there's just more talent out west this year, unfortunately.
Absolutely. A lot of growth out west. Grand Canyon is continuing to perform well despite the loss of Carson Barton. Arizona State has been consistently ranked number one for the first time in their program's history. The WCLL is really a conundrum. They're always a four-team powerhouse between Cal, Stanford, Sonoma, and Cal Poly, and they might just get the AQ this year, and we'll see how that ultimately unfolds. But, you know, let's bring things back to Davenport. You know, they had that big win over Michigan State and then played in this rivalry game, which I think it's very impressive that the Grand Rapids community and the Davenport coaching staff continues to keep GVSU on the schedule for the sake of the rivalry. You guys were unbelievable rivals in your Division II days. You know, we'll talk about a Final Four game, which you played against Davenport a little bit later. You know, I spoke to Coach Murray about this. There are so many kids who ultimately make their decision between Grand Valley and Davenport. It seems like there are a lot of guys on both sides who played against each other in high school. A semi-pro box team that you have experience playing with, it seems like it's essentially a Grand Valley State Davenport all-star team to a certain degree. Other than those reasons, you know, what do you think makes this Davenport rivalry so special? And, you know, how great was it for Grand Valley State to knock off the Panthers this year when they were on a high horse having upset Michigan State?
I think you included every reason there, actually. I wasn't one of the kids that played in the west side of Michigan, but so many of the guys on both teams played each other or played with each other. You know, they've just been growing up either on the field with them or against them. The Dragonfish, there are a lot of GV, a lot of Davenport players. I think it's great. Just, you know, you got to have a rivalry. And there are a lot of teams in Division II CCLA that don't have the talent. And so a team that's so close to you that has the talent, it's just going to be a great game. More fans are going to come out because it's, you know, way shorter of a drive, just a few minutes away. More people, you know, playing against your friends or your enemies, if you will, you know, it just makes it so much better. And since it's two very talented teams that know each other well, the stakes are always high, you know, and it was rivalry that I loved.
Absolutely. And it seems like, you know, especially in Division II games, this was a team that you could have ultimately seen three times in a given year: regular season, conference championship, and the MCLA tournament, which you know very well. But now that Davenport's a Division I team, you know, it's great that Coach Gravatt keeps Grand Valley State on the schedule. And, you know, the win that GVSU had this year will certainly guarantee that the rivalry at least extends into next year, because, you know, the Panthers are going to want revenge. And I have confidence that this will continue to be on the schedule regardless of how long Davenport stays an MCLA Division I team and GVSU stays in Division II. But, you know, it's, even though there are interdivisional games and even though, you know, the myth that Division I teams are always better than Division II teams, that's been squashed. I think that Westminster kind of squashed that even before they made the jump. But the MCLA really has yet to address how interdivisional chain games really ultimately affect a team's power ranking. In this circumstance, should Davenport take a hit for losing to Grand Valley State in the polls as far as their rankings and their at-large consideration is concerned? Or, you know, should the proximity of the rivalry and the resources that GVSU has that Davenport necessarily doesn't have from a school size standpoint, and the way that that dichotomy kind of exists with the way that Davenport is one of those NAIA model schools that offer scholarships, how should the MCLA address interdivisional games, especially when high-ranked Division I teams sometimes lose to a very good Division II team?
Yeah, you know, I think it's circumstantial. If a great Division II team beats a bad Division I team, I don't think it should be any less of a loss for that D1 team. You know, if a good team beats another good team, it should count regardless of whether Division I or Division II. You know, Davenport, Michigan State, Grand Valley, we always play each other. Those three teams, regardless of one or two, are always going to play each other, and it's a great game. And I think that the Division I and II isn't a talent division. It has much more off the field reasons of why teams are split the way they were.
Yep.
So to me, it should be, you know, each game was a good loss, if you will, or a bad loss or a good win. It shouldn't just be a Division I versus Division II conversation. There's too much else behind those, you know, splits to decide, you know, whether that's that goes one way or the other. You know, it's circumstantial per game.
Absolutely. And let's just quickly switch gears back to Palm Beach Atlantic. We mentioned that they will be joining NCAA come the 2018 academic year. You said that you think that they'll be very, very strong for the next couple years that they remain in the MCLA. You know, they host a great event in the early season, which really tends to benefit some of the best Division II teams across the country, because they're able to pull from the Midwest like you guys in the CCLA or the better teams of the UMLC. They've even gotten Coast Guard from the PCLL, who, of course, is another team that will soon be making the jump to the NCAA ranks. But ultimately, Palm Beach Atlantic going to the NCAA in 2018, is this a big loss for the MCLA, or do you think that with the way that the sport of the Southeast is growing, that a replacement will be found and that the competition level in SCLC and MCLA Division II will find a way to stay the same after they progress?
You know, it's tough. I think there will be new teams progressing. Surprisingly, there is a lot of growth of lacrosse in Florida, I think, in just kind of that southern area, just because you can play all year round.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whether it's a loss, yeah, sure. When anytime a good team leaves, it does hurt. But I'm sure there'll be more teams coming up, and there'll be talent in that area still, I'm sure.
No question. So, you know, Andrew, we're really going to have to ask you to, you know, look into your crystal ball and, you know, strap on your analyst hard hat tight and make a few predictions here. You know, you've been a part of the Final Four in your playing career and know what it takes to get to that level and even make it to the national championship game. Two divisions, eight teams, predict the Final Four in each division for the MCLA National Championships.
Yeah, this is hard in Division One, I think. There's a lot of good teams at the top that all have great schedules. And you know, their losses are to each other. So
Right.
it's hard to pick a clear winners here. But I gotta say, Arizona State is obviously the first choice for me. I mean, undefeated, how can you not pick them in the Final Four? BYU, I have in the Final Four. And then I'd say Chapman. Those are three top four teams. But then I'm gonna go my kind of upset, I guess, if you will be Grand Canyon instead of picking Colorado. I think they're a good tournament team. Their losses, a few goals to Colorado State and a few goals to Arizona State. I see them making a play in the tournament. And then just for fun, my kind of sleeper team, I guess, would be Westminster. I'm curious to see how they'll finish. I don't know if it's a Final Four, but I think they're a good team, and we'll have to see what happens. Division Two, I think the clear number one again is or the number one is clear again. It's Dayton. I'm really impressed with their play this year. St. John's, they've always been a top team. And then I'm going to go St. Thomas. They've had a down year this year, but I think the style of play bodes well for the tournament. They like to play defense, keep the scoring low. That's just a good plan for the tournament. I mean, that just is going to be a successful team. And then I have to go with the alma mater, Grand Valley. I know they're fifth right now in the nation, so it's not too big an upset. But you know, they have a lot of talent in the freshman class. I'm really surprised with how well they played. A lot of seniors graduated last year. A lot of players left for personal reasons and whatnot. And it's just a very strong freshman team. But I think Coach Murray has done a good job of keeping those guys in the zone. I think they're making a tournament run. And then again, another fun pick. I'd say Western Oregon. They have a powerful offense. These guys, I haven't seen them play in person this season. But they're all about offense, and that's fun for the tournament. I don't know if their defense will hold up against some of the better teams, but be fun to watch.
Pretty interesting set of picks there. So in Division One, you have two teams from the RMLC and two teams from the SLC. Not necessarily a surprise from the conference dichotomy, but you have Colorado and Colorado State, the champion, the two teams that played in the championship game last year. You have them out of the Final Four, and you have their foes from the RMLC, Westminster and BYU, in there. You have ASU making the Final Four for what must be now the fifth consecutive year, which will be no surprise. And their arch rival, Grand Canyon, who beat them in the regular season last year. You have also sneaking in, and then Division Two, you're going with your alma mater. You mentioned some of the fall off that you've had, and it really is impressive how great your alma mater has performed, especially with Danny Kranzberger taking the year off to take advantage of an ROTC scholarship. I think that he's an MCLA Division II Player of the Year candidate year in, year out. That kid always plays well when the big lights are on, and it's impressive that Coach Murray has put some young goaltenders in there and still hasn't really skipped a beat as far as winning. And then Dayton back on top. You have them as a clear-cut favorite to make it back. And you can't really argue with the fact that St. John's and St. Thomas, always play very, very well in the tournament. And you hit the nail right on the head. The way that St. Thomas and Colorado State specifically play their defensive style of games, it's just produced so much success in consecutive seasons in MCLA tournaments. It's hard to stay away from, but it's really hard to steer away from. But we'll see. We'll see if BYU emerges as the number three team in the RMLC or the number two team right now in front of Colorado State to make it in there, and if Westminster could squeak in as well. I think that they have a good chance of getting an at-large bid, and they're certainly a team that knows how to win in the Division II tournament, and they're certainly poised to make a Division I run as well. So, keeping the prediction hat and the analyst hat on, if you had to take a player of the year and a coach of the year in each division, four individuals who really represent the MCLA well, who would you pick?
Well, let's start Division One Player of the Year. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm have to go with Dom Boggiano at Davenport. I'm surprised to see a lot of players from Texas in the top point getters this year. But Boggiano, year in, year out, he's put up a ton of goals, ton of points. This year's no different. You know, he's if you ever played against him, he's kind of a hothead. You know, he's a cheeky player, but at the end of the day, he still puts the ball in the net, and that's who I have to give it to this year. For Division One Coach of the Year, I'm not entirely convinced I'm picking the right coach here, but I'm going to go with actually Northeastern's Ben Cervantes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I just say that is because they were unranked going into the season. They're 18th right now. 7 wins this season, kind of a surprise, and I believe he is also a first year coach.
Absolutely,
so
yep.
So you know, it's just good to see that he's had success in Division Two. I don't know if this is a sort of sellout kind of comment for the Player of the Year, but I'm just going to go with the Western Oregon attackman. You got 4 of the top 5 scorers are from, or 4 of the top 6, excuse me, are from Western Oregon. So I mean, when 4 players all have 75 points or more, I just got to give it to all 4 of those guys: Clay Masalik, Taylor Duggan, Josh Bohens, and Brandon Detterman. Usually, if you see a player with that many points, you know, it's the style is, you know, get the ball to that guy. But when you have 4 players over 75 points, I just got to give it to the whole attack in there. Then for Coach of the Year, for me, this was kind of easy. I went with Dayton's coach, Joe Fanchirilla, first-year coach. He took over for Charlie Mack, who I think is probably the most well-known lacrosse figure in the Midwest, in UCLA, or at least just lacrosse in general. So to take over for him and then put Dayton, you know, as where they are this season, I just think it's great. I think that was an easy coach of the year for me.
Absolutely. Hitting a lot of interesting points there. You know, a lot of people, you know, I think that, you know, it's really, even though we've spoken about how, you know, there isn't necessarily always a huge talent gap between Division One and Division Two, you know, it is a change in atmosphere when you do make that jump. And, you know, Davenport has made that jump recently. Westminster has made that jump recently. Liberty has made that jump recently. But, you know, I really thought that Jordan Richmeyer, as well as Don Boggiano, had a great year last year. Richmeyer was a senior and kind of missed out on being an MCLA Division One All-American, even though his numbers were still very impressive. And I think it would be a shame if Don Boggiano got left out of the conversation with the way that he's been able to perform. Definitely a water bug style attackman who knows how to put the ball in the net and, you know, really lets his stats instead of his size do the talking. And then, you know, you mentioned the big scores from Texas State. We spoke about Liam Kelly, the Bellarmine transfer from Canada, and Andy Ull and the big numbers that they're putting up. And, you know, 2 great Coach of the Year candidates as well. Joe Ventrula taking over for Charlie Mark. You know, Dayton had a down year last year, and Don Vince came to the tournament, you know, by himself to represent Dayton and, you know, get a good grasp as to what he needed to do to hire a good coach, and found a real winner in Joe Ventrula, who's really taken Dayton from a point of being always a dominant MCLA Division II team to a squad that, you know, got shortly forgotten last year as Charlie Mark was on his way out and dealing with some personal health matters. And, you know, for his own benefit and for the program's benefit, was good enough to step away and let some young blood take over the reins. And Joe Ventrella has done a good job. And, Ben Severance at Northeastern taking over for James Morin, not an easy role to come into. Northeastern does do a good job of cultivating their assistant coaches into Division One, and I agree that Northeastern has been very impressive. They had a bit of a questionable Division Two loss to Briarcliff early in the year, but Northeastern certainly responded well. And you know, to see two coaches like Ventrulo and Severance come into their head coaching roles and accepted so well, I think you know, definitely a solid Coach of the Year candidates. So we'll bring things back, you know, to things that are more linked to your personal experience. We're right at the cusp of conference tournament time. The LSA's tournament has started, and the fields are just getting announced for the other tournaments. When your regular season ends, Andrew, and you're getting ready for the postseason, whether you know you're an at-large team or you're fighting for a conference championship to solidify your spot, you're a two-time conference champ. So for the 2 years that you spent in the MCLA at Grand Valley, you knew nothing besides winning CCLA championships. What do you think, from a team preparation standpoint, is the most important thing when you're shifting gears from the regular season to the regional postseason, if you're, you know, and you continue to prepare for the national tournament that might come thereafter?
I think it's just a few simple things. One, it's just continue to get in shape. You know, conditioning doesn't end when the season starts. You got to keep going. The national tournament, 4 games in 6 days. It's in heat. You have to be in shape. The sort of the week off that we had between conference and the national tournament, we conditioned, and you know, some teams do, some teams don't, and I think it pays off. Fourth quarter, it's a close game. The teams that condition are going to have the hustle to keep going. It's an important thing, and I think once you're in the national title game, it's hot, you're exhausted. That conditioning is going to go a long way. And then making sure you know your plays, having the whole offense just fully understand everything, the defense fully understanding everything. Not just knowing your role in the offense, but knowing all 6 positions, all 4 lines of middies. You know, every player knowing everything is just really important. You know, kind of that week prep that you have between conference and nationals. Just make sure you are fully dialed in. I mean, that's really what it's about. It's about running. It's about keeping your stick hot. And just making sure everyone is on the exact same page and you guys are ready to go play.
And you talk about people being on the same page and playing 4 games in 5 days in the heat. Depth certainly becomes a factor. So you bring up an interesting point, especially from an offensive midfielder perspective, which you know a lot about, knowing that playbook and being able to execute in situations where you might not be asked to be in those situations at certain points of the season when you're just kind of playing 1 or 2 games at a time. The gears really shift when you get into the postseason, and conditioning and knowledge of the playbook and knowing your identity, I have to agree, are definitely the biggest parts of focusing and dialing in when you prepare for postseason success, when putting the regular season behind you, whether it was a prolific one or a disappointing one. And, Andrew, I saw firsthand you have some really special moments in the MCLA tournament when you were a player, 2 of which, I saw firsthand in 2012, actually, the first year in Greenville. You had a hat trick in that opening rounds game against Wash U. And then in the final 4 against Davenport, you actually scored 2 goals. I was really excited to be the play-by-play announcer in that game and be able to, experience your goal calls with you. You know, those are 2 pretty big experiences. You know, if you had to pick out your best overall MCLA tournament experience, is it the hat trick against Wash U? Is it the 2 goals against your arch rival in the final 4 when you beat Davenport in 2012, or was there something perhaps also from 2012 or last year that I missed out that you really feel as though embodies and defines your experiences in the MCLA tournament?
See, that last part, I thought this was going to be an easy question. I'd have to say my best good moment would definitely be the 2 goals against Davenport. Meeting your arch rival, the winner goes to the championship game. Scoring 2 goals, that was awesome. And they were big goals. Yep. And it just pushed us on. That's probably one of my favorite games that I ever played. For some reason, whatever it could be, I always scored a lot of goals against Dayton, whether it was preseason, during the season, or in the playoffs. I always found a way to put the ball in the back of the net against them. But something, honestly, that in my mind kind of defines my tournament was the national championship game my senior year. It still eats me today. I was on the doorstep. Could have got an easy goal and just got stuffed. And since it was a one goal loss, it was just in the first half, but since it was a 1 goal loss, that still eats at me. So I'll always remember that, even though it's not a great memory. Losing to by 1 goal in the national title game is never an easy thing to swallow.
Honest and fair, that's all you could really ask for. And, I know that those 2 goals were especially special. Your family was there. I remember your parents coming toward the booth after the game. Your mom had a text from your grandpa who was watching on the internet and was excited to watch you score those 2 goals. And, unfortunately, I remember the shot you missed in the St. Thomas game the next day as well. And I remember you actually writing about it for your blog on Inside Lacrosse that season and really wanting to rectify things the following year. And, it was unfortunate that the Lakers, with the young team that you had last year, didn't quite make it back to the Final 4, but did have that great win against SCAD in the tournament. So, Andrew, a real veteran for the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast, you know, a lot of really important topics from, you know, the tournament field for this year, the location of the tournament, your personal experiences, what it's like, you know, transitioning from the NCAA to MCLA and the relationships that those two leagues have. You know, on a final closing note, you know, if you had, you know, one opportunity, I know that you're in Fort Wayne, Indiana right now, only a few hours from your home back in Michigan, but if Tim Murray were to invite you back to practice for one last opportunity to approach your old squad as they prepare for the CCLA tournament and the MCLA tournament thereafter, if there's one message that you could send to your Laker brethren at this point of the season, if you had an opportunity, you really have the opportunity now because a lot of your old teammates and your brethren from GVSU will probably be listening to this podcast with Coach Murray. What do you have to say to your Lakers? You know, they have an opportunity. You know, they're ranked fifth in the country. They're right there. Certainly not out of the national championship picture. You know, what would you say to the Lakers to light a fire under their butts and, you know, get them, you know, to push past that barrier? Two times in the national championship game, two times a bridesmaid, never a bride. If that has to change, what's your message?
I got one simple thing to say is change planes on your shots. Hustle for every ground ball. Those, I mean, those are two things that that Murray always said. You know, he always got pissed when we shot sidearm or high to high. Even though that's a lot of flashier, changing planes. You know, in 5 years you won't remember how you took the shot. You just remember if you won or not. So just take the smart shots. Hustle for the ground balls. That's it.
That's awesome, Andrew. Andrew Laycock, thank you so much for joining us in this very special nearing postseason edition of the MCLA Inside Lacrosse podcast. As always, we would like to thank the MCLA administration, most notably MCLA President Ken Lovick and newly appointed Director of Public Relations Dan Morris, accepting a new role, very well respected and should be doing great things in California this year. Thanks, as always, to our executive producers from Inside Lacrosse, John Gelati and Terry Foy. For Andrew Laycock, I'm David Franklin. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. We will join you one more time next week before we all head out to sunny California to see who emerges as the 2014 National Championships in MCLA. Thank you very much for your time this evening, and we will see you again next week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.